You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacey. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, August 25th, 2016.
I don't feel like it's been more challenging or less challenging because of my gender, especially in this town. I mean, there are a lot of women business owners here.
Bloomington business owners Joni McGarry and Jane Coopersmith join Michael Glab on today's edition of Big Talk. That's coming up later in the show. But first, these local headlines.
The Ellisville Town Council is considering charging $150 for each public records request of police body camera and dash cam footage. If they do so, they will join the Bloomington Police Department in charging the maximum fee allowed by law. In the town council's meeting this week, Attorney Darla Brown said, by law, the town can't charge a retrieval fee, but it can charge up to $150 per item to cover copying and storage costs.
And the reason for that is there are things that need to be redacted from the body cam footage if someone makes a request. Like, for example, if there's a confidential informant in there, that has to be redacted or blacked out somehow. If there's an undercover officer who's worked on the case, that person's identity needs to be redacted or taken out of the public record. If there's an individual's, if the footage shows a dead body, severe violence, nudity, a young child, all of that has to be redacted.
In addition, Brown said statute requires body camera footage be held for 190 days. Brown noted victims of crime and those involved with the crime are able to look at the footage for free. Police Chief Jim Durnell said his department has the capacity to do the redacting, but storage is the issue.
We have right now probably two officers that can do that. One maybe, and of course Zach can do it, but it just takes time. And the big factor is the storage, and that's why our policy has been amended to do officer discretion. So we don't record the whole 8 hours of a shift. We officer discretion. I either want to go all the way or none, but yet we can't afford to store 8 hours times 10 people cameras, so we can't do it. That was if you remember, we bought some computer equipment back in April, and it was about $2,000 for that. And Zach said we'd probably fill that up in 6 months if we did it all 8 hours a day. So that's why we amended that to. But it's done in house. The problem isn't so much the actual. Of course, it's going to take time to find what they want and put it on there. But it's a storage issue. It's what we hope to recoup some money on that.
Councilmember Scott Thomas asked Brown if she considered how much other police departments charge before proposing the $150 fee.
Is that amount, I mean, as a layperson, I don't know, that seems expensive to me. Is that standard?
The honest answer is I don't know. I just went with what the maximum was allowed by statute.
Councilmember Diana Baston defended the proposal to charge the maximum fee.
Paid an officer hourly their true wage with benefits, it wouldn't take you very long to get to 150. So having a flat, I mean, it sounds like a lot to me. I agree with Scott, it sounds like a lot, but when you put it that way, hourly, then it's to me a wash.
The council has not yet approved the fee.
An event planned for next week in Bloomington is intended to bring attention to issues surrounding pets and homelessness. Filmmaker and Los Angeles social worker Christine Kim is presenting a film series called My Dog is My Home. The screening is set for 6:30 p.m. on Monday at The Void on South Rogers Street. Kim says the film series was inspired by her work with people experiencing homelessness in L.A.'s Skid Row neighborhood.
At my time in the housing program, I met this one individual who really changed my life and changed the way that I view this issue. And what happened to him was that he was brand new to our housing program. He moved in. He had his dog with him, and he knew that there was a no pets allowed rule. So what he did was he hid the dog for as long as he could. But, you know, eventually the staff caught wind of that, and he was kind of faced with this horrible ultimatum of either getting out of the housing program and keeping his dog, or he could get rid of his dog and stay in housing. And that's actually a really common thing that happens.
Kim has been traveling the country screening her films, which feature people telling stories about their lives with their animals. She says she frequently encounters people who suggest homeless people should not be allowed to own pets due to concerns about animal welfare.
I really have to tell them that that's not the case. I can understand why they arrive at that conclusion, because the dog didn't have a say in who they were going to live with and where they were going to live. But in reality, the dogs live very happy, well-adjusted, socialized lives. They get to spend 24/7 with their human companion, and that is really the most important thing to a dog. There was an article that was put out about the homeless population in Rio de Janeiro that cares for, like, street dogs, and the author of that article put it really beautifully, so I just want to quote him. That housing is a human construct, not a canine one. What is important to dogs above all else is that they have human companionship, and they have that in abundance.
Kim will be speaking with the audience after the films are finished. The event on Monday at The Void at 1607 South Rogers Street is part of a larger plan to eventually hold what Kim called a service fair for homeless pets in Bloomington. That fair would provide veterinary care, grooming, and other services to the pets of people experiencing homelessness. Kim said she is hoping to recruit a group of local people to work on that project.
Organizers are preparing for the 5th Annual Garlic Fest this weekend in downtown Bloomington. The festival begins at 10 a.m. on both Saturday and Sunday at 3rd Street Park. One of the organizers, Dave Cox, says the event is scheduled to draw artists from around the state.
We have about 35 or 36 artists at this point. We're having five of the local artisans doing live demos with castings and blacksmithing and glass blowing, armor and leather making, and some really wild textile stuff.
The Garlic Fest describes itself as an opportunity to celebrate healthy lifestyle choices and support local artists and musicians. Groups including the White Lightning Boys, the Velours, and 800 Pound Gorilla are scheduled to perform. The festival takes place just down the street from the annual 4th Street Festival, which is also scheduled for this Saturday and Sunday. That festival hosts over 100 artisans from across the country who will offer their work to the public. Weather forecast for this weekend call for highs in the upper 80s with chances of scattered thunderstorms both days.
In its work session this week, the Monroe County Council reviewed a recommendation by a subcommittee of the Monroe County Tax Council for allocating the recently approved public safety income tax. The subcommittee recommended allocating approximately $390,000 to fire departments and emergency medical services in the county's townships. Councilmember Ryan Cobine listed some of the fire departments who would receive funding.
Bean Blossom Steinsville Volunteer Fire Department Incorporated, $17,000. Benton Township Volunteer Fire Department, $25,000. Northern Monroe County Fire Protection Territory, $25,000. Indian Creek Firefighters Incorporated, $30,000. Washington Township, $50,000. Van Buren Township Fire Department, $60,000. Ellettsville Fire Department, $90,000. Perry Clear Creek Fire Protection District, $94,560.
The public safety tax is estimated to bring in nearly $7 million in new revenue. 30% of that money will be taken off the top to fund the county's emergency dispatch center. County Attorney Michael Flory said that percentage will be reduced in the future, potentially freeing up more dollars for fire departments.
One way that that might be accomplished is with what we're moving forward on the replacement resolution, we're cutting the funding to dispatch solely in terms of the percentage that automatically would go to them. It still seems to be a very healthy amount of money, and quite a bit can be done with that, but it may mean additional money coming into the coffers of the other units that could somehow choose to fund the fire department through some other mechanism. But it's going to be a complex mechanism because the fire district, as I understand, cannot own property.
Earlier this month, the Monroe County Income Tax Council learned it will have to readopt the tax before October 31st to be able to continue collecting it after December 31st. Munson said the county got caught up in a discrepancy with the state's Department of Local Government Finance, DLGF, over interpretation of law.
The tax for the public safety local option income tax will be in effect October 1, and that's when it will be collected. But you can't allocate it to any government units for spending because we did not have it in place by May 1. In order to be able to allocate that money, we have to pass an additional continuation, if you will, ordinance called a local income tax, which is planned to be the same amount for the same purpose, and a resolution for an ordinance will be considered by the very same group of councils, and that has to be done by October 1st.
Councilmember Marty Hawk cautioned everyone against making firm plans for the tax revenue.
That is so important because we do not have in place right now a guarantee that we are going to have this tax in place as of January 1. That's not to say it won't happen, it's just to say it has not happened. So we want to make sure that no one counts on and budgets these dollars until we've got all of it done.
The state will have to approve a new ordinance for the county to continue to collect the tax in 2017. County Attorney Michael Flory said his office was working with the DLGF to craft an ordinance the state will approve.
Project Appleseed, a group pushing to get parents more involved in their children's education, reports that there has been some progress since the group was established over two decades ago, but much more needs to be done. Kevin Walker, Project Appleseed's president, says many parents never have any communication with their child's teacher outside parent-teacher conferences, and many parents don't attend them either. He would like to see legislation to provide affordable broadband access to parents, which would expand an initial program, Lifeline, set up in the 1980s, to make television or telephone service more affordable. Such legislation would give those below the poverty level a subsidy to pay for an internet connection. Walker says, quote, "What parents need is important information sent home on a regular basis by email. That would mean they'd be checking on school, checking on their kids, looking for a job, and engaging themselves in the larger community," unquote. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ryan Stacey. Bloomington business owners Joni McGarry and Jane Coopersmith join Michael Glab on today's Big Talk. Joni owns Lucky Guy Bakery, and Jane is co-owner of Hopscotch Coffee. Joni grew up in an era when women still were expected to stay home and keep house. Jane came of age at a time when the first women had entered a somewhat more gender-inclusive business world. Obstacles remain for women in business, but some old prejudices are slipping away. They explore the challenges facing women entrepreneurs and discuss how women can help each other succeed.
Hi, this is Michael Glab, Big Mike, with Big Talk. My guests today are two very, very ambitious and successful women business owners. Directly on my left is Jane Coopersmith, who owns Hopscotch Coffee.
Co-owns.
To her left is Joni McGarry, who owns Lucky Guy Bakery. Jane, when you were a little girl, did you have a sense that a grown-up woman could get into business?
Yeah, I think so. It's been a while. My dad owned a small business. He was an environmental engineer, and he owned a small company that sort of interfaced with industry and the EPA, so I kind of grew up in his lab. And he really wanted me to be a chemical engineer. And so I think that doing something technical or professional was definitely always available as an option.
And Jane, where was this that you grew up?
This was in Keokuk, Iowa.
Joni, where do you come from?
Originally, I'm from a town called Herkimer, New York, which is right in the middle of New York State.
Small town?
Oh, when I was growing up, it was 9,000 or 10,000 people, and now I would say it's probably about 7.
As I asked Jane, did you have any notion when you were a young girl that a woman could grow up to run a business?
I don't know if I thought about growing up to run a business. But I think, and we were talking about like engineering and math and science before a little bit. I was a math science kid, and I just, yeah, definitely. And I thought that I would just be a doctor because that was, to me, like the thing that I should be, which, of course, I didn't end up being. But I don't know that I had a lot of role models of women who owned businesses. I mean, I knew somebody's mom owned a flower shop. My mom and most other moms at that time, and, you know, I was born in 1962, they were pretty much stay-at-home moms. So I never thought of that I would grow up to be a homemaker. I figured I'd do something. I started the business sort of on a whim. And it's great because it's the first thing I've done in that time that's not in a supportive role.
Do you feel, either one, that owning a business as a woman is particularly challenging?
I haven't had the experience that it's been difficult for me. And maybe it's because it's so small at this point, and because my experience has been in selling, and maybe this is going to sound really sexist, but it's also in a kitchen arts type of environment, but not a chef environment, because I work around other people who are young women who felt very challenged by being a woman as a chef.
Is that so?
Because that's a very male-dominated field. But I don't feel like it's been more challenging or less challenging because of my gender, especially in this town. I mean, I think it's a pretty, there are a lot of women business owners here. I mean, I look at the, like, Yugo Bars, Piccoli Dolce, mm-hmm. you know.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of non-food related businesses as well.
Oh, definitely. I'm just,
we could name them.
Susie Yeagley, who owns the Bloomington Body Bar. Caroline Dowd Higgins has her own, like, branded franchise.
And Hugo is Tracy Gates and
Rebecca and Walter. Mm-hmm. As an aside, we were talking about things earlier, not in here, but we were talking about how things have changed. And when I bought my first house, I was legally referred to on that paperwork as Joni Ruller, because that was my maiden name, which is also a crazy thing, maiden name, comma, spinster.
As I think about it, a number of your vendors are women.
Mm-hmm.
Piccolo Dolce and Joni.
Oh, the Hopscotch was my first customer.
And Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean anything to you? I mean, is that just dumb luck? Or did you say, you know what? I'm going to help Joni.
No, not at all. I mean, I really think it kind of is dumb luck that these are. I love working with these women, and they're powerful. And I think the common denominator among us small business owning women is that we're self-starters, and we're pretty energetic, and we tend to not let grass grow, I guess. So I really enjoy the camaraderie, and I enjoy talking with these people. But they have great products, and that's why they're in our shop.
The funny thing about it was, you know, now, you know, we make, I don't know, almost 400 brownies a batch. But Jane and Jeff ordered, I think it was 3 dozen brownies. And it took me days to get those together and in the boxes just right, and I was such a wreck about it. I
mean, we didn't know that.
No,
you were cool as a cucumber.
Yeah, I was trying to act like, oh, I do this all the time. It was like, you know, like the man behind the curtain or the woman behind the curtain.
Have any women come to you and asked for help, knowledge, advice in how to start their own businesses?
It's just about everybody who has come to me has been a woman.
So do you see yourself now, to a certain extent, as a mentor?
Well, of somebody who doesn't know anything, sure. I mean, yeah, I think, and I bet you would agree, Jane, that, and you've been in it longer than I have, and I think your operation
like 5 minutes longer.
Much more complicated because you have a store and a lot of employees. You come up to speed really fast on a lot of things, so that it doesn't take a really long time for you to be able to help somebody else who's at the starting line. It helps somebody else a lot. Yeah. And that also feels really empowering and fun and good.
You know, I was trying to remember too. I'm like, well, is it mainly, what's the balance? Has it mainly been women or men or both asking us for advice? And I think it's been a little bit of a mix. We've had this weird magnet attached to our business, which is the empty space next door to Hopscotch. So often people will say, has anybody rented that space yet? And then...
Do they always ask like that?
Yeah, totally. It's a secret. No, really, people want to flip their ideas by. There have been a wide range of people who've asked about it. I think one thing, having the cafe retail space and working through the complex requirements to get there, it makes you want to help whoever is going through that. So I don't think that we're experts in anything necessarily, but just having walked through all of the certifications and inspections and everything, if you can save anybody time.
Oh, definitely.
It's helpful. So I think that mainly is where we share info.
Well, I think, yeah, and where I work, because it's a commissary environment, there are a lot of other small and medium-sized food companies who work there. So there's always a collaboration and a sharing of ideas.
You're both married. Is there any responsibility that falls upon the spouse when you are the business owner and you're consumed with all these ideas and all these responsibilities? How does the spouse help out, if at all?
I have a really great partner in my husband, and so I think he tries to be really supportive. And then in turn, I try to have good boundaries about the business. I try not to do business things after a certain hour so that I can be mom and be a good partner.
Do you find that difficult?
Yes, yeah, it's incredibly difficult, and I definitely don't succeed all the time. But conversely, we made the choice to pursue this business very much together. And so I think he kind of had an idea about what we were signing up for as a household.
How about you, Joan?
I had been a traditional, in a really traditional household for the past, since my son was born, which is something I never thought I would have ever done because I was so career-oriented before I got married. But so we had formed these patterns of being in a really traditional situation, and I did all the homemaking. There was a little bit of an adjustment when I started out, even though he was extremely supportive. You know, he's like, definitely do it. And my son Jack was old enough that he doesn't require, you know, a lot of hand holding all the time. He's 15 now. But yeah, there was definitely there were some rough patches at the beginning. And I don't know if it's just because, you know, dinner wasn't made and the laundry wasn't done and all the things that in our partnership I was responsible for, and I didn't mind doing it, and I still don't. It just got to be a time issue. Yeah. So there was a little push and pull with that. And for me, it just also involved just getting a little more organized. We're all kind of used to it now, and we adjusted. And most of that adjustment was my own. I mean, life's too short. I mean, if everything's not dusted and dinner's not, you know, perfect, you know, who cares? But I sure cared for a long time.
It occurs to me that I would never ask these questions of a man in business.
No, you wouldn't. No one ever does.
That was Lucky Guy Bakery owner Joni McCary and Hopscotch Coffee owner Jane Coopersmith speaking on this week's edition of Big Talk with Michael Glapp.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197. You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford and Kathy Norton, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ryan Stacey.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.